Good morning and good evening. My name is Rohit and I'm your host for today's Awaken Talk. Welcome and thank you for joining us. Awaken Talks is a space where we hold conversations with individuals whose inner journeys inspire us and whose work is transforming our world in large and small ways. It's an all-volunteer run offering of Service Space, a global platform founded on the simple principle that by changing ourselves, we change the world. Thank you for joining us. Today, the theme we want to explore is How Much is Enough? With Vidya Shah, Amit Bhatia, and moderated by Birju Pandya. We will start with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves in the present moment. Thank you. Now I would like to invite a dear friend, Trupti, who is a psychologist, healer, and a community servant working with children with special needs, to open the our day today with a song offering. Trupti herself has had an inspiring journey with the question of how much is enough, including when a year and a half ago, she along with her sister embarked on a 3,400 kilometer long walking pilgrimage along the river Narmada in India with almost no money and resources to grow in the inner wealth of surrender and grace, relying upon the kindness of the others for their day-to-day survival. And the song which Trupti is going to offer is a Gujarati song called Ochintu by poet Dhruv Bhatt, which speaks of the benevolence of nature, Kudrat ni Rehm, and the joy of being alive. While walking along the banks of River Narmada, Dhruv Bhatt once came across a farmer working in his field under a blazing sun. When he asked how the farmer was doing, the farmer turned to him with a 1,000-watt smile and replied with no hint of self-pity on his face that he was full of joy, that he was full of Kudrat ni Rehm. That moved something internally for Dhruv Dada, who was in his own pilgrimage at that time, in his attitude to the farmer, to himself, and inspired this poem. Over to Trupti, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rohit. ओचिंतु कोई मने रस्ते मड़े ने कदी धीरे थी पूछे के कैम छे आपड़े तो कहिए के दरिया शी मौज मा ने ऊपर थी कुदरत नी रहम छे ओचिंतु कोई मने रस्ते मड़े ने पची धीरे थी पूछे के केम छे आपड़े तो कहिए के दरिया शी मौज मा ने ऊपर थी कुदरत नी रहम छे फाटेला खिस्सानी आड़ मा मुकी छे अमे छलकाती मलकाती मौज फाटेला खिस्सानी आड़ मा मुकी छे अमे छलकाती मलकाती मौज एकलो उभो हूं तो ए मेड़ा मा हो एम लाग्या करे छे मने रोज ताड़ू बसाए नहीं हो ताड़ू बसाए नहीं बड़ी पटारी मा आपड़ो खजानो हेम खेम छे आपड़े तो कहिए के दरिया शी मौज मा ने ऊपर थी कुदरत नी रहम छे आँखो ना पानी तो आवे ने जाए नथी भीतर भी नाश थती ओछी आँखो ना पानी तो आवे ने जाए नथी भीतर भी नाश थती ओछी वधगट ना काठाओ राखे ही साब नहीं परवा समंदर ने होती सूरज तो उगे ने हो सूरज तो उगे ने आत्मीए जाए मारी ऊपर आकाश एम ने मुझे आपड़े तो कहिए के दरिया शी मौज मा ने ऊपर थी कुदरत नी रहम छे ओ चिंतु कोई मने रस्ते मड़े ने कदी धीरे थी पूछे के कैम छे आपड़े तो कहिए के दरिया शी मौज मा ने ऊपर थी कुदरत नी रहम छे ऊपर थी कुदरत नी रहम छे ओ ऊपर थी मालिक नी रहम छे
Thank you, Trupti, for that beautiful offering. The shore may keep a track of the waves, but the ocean does not keep track. Thank you. And with that, I would just quickly share on the call flow. In the first part of the call, Birju, who is our host today, will invite Vidya and Amit to share their thoughts on the question of how much is enough. And in the second part of the call, we'll have a more free-flowing conversation between the three of them and also including all your questions, which is all the questions from the audience. So you can share in a comment or a question or a reflection via the comment box of the live stream website, or you can also do it by sending us an email at ask@servicespace.org. With that, I'll just take the opportunity to invite Birju. Someone who I feel deeply inspired by. He is an MBA from Columbia Business School, and he started as a consultant at McKinsey, and after that he has spent a lot of time working in finance. But one of the first stories which I heard about Birju, which really surprised and took me by surprise, was that he was working at an impact investment fund. And after his first year, his boss comes and tells him, Birju, you have done well. So what do you want? Which is like a quintessential blank check of investment banking. Birju thought for a bit, he paused for a minute, and then he asked, what I really want is a minute of silence in all our team meetings. I don't know what got Birju to say that, but it didn't take much time for his boss to say no, but he thought for a bit, and next day he came back and said, Birju, that this is really an awkward ask, that to where we bill every minute to ask for a minute of silence in all our meetings, but if this is really what you want, I'll give it to you. And so that minute turned to 2 minutes, turned to 5 minutes, and they started doing 30 minutes once a week. And it didn't stop there. It went further beyond, where they started doing acts of kindness as a team. And as he said, that investment bankers started talking about their feelings. And it even rippled out into the way they engage with their clients and everything. So, and that is, I think, a great manifestation of Birju's interest in the field of integrated capital, that how do we use money capital to thrive and cultivate other forms of non-financial forms of capital. And Birju, we are delighted to have you join today from California, and over to you for the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rohit, for such a kind-hearted introduction, building off of the blessings from the heart of Trupti, and just feeling really grateful for that as a container for this conversation. And really excited to be in dialogue with two leaders in impact and social enterprise. I'll just name a little bit of, for transparency's sake, I'm calling today from my kitchen, and because I don't want to be sharing that as a background, you have this lovely librarian context that I'll be sharing today. And I'm going to offer a little of opening remarks and then try to create as much space for our guests to offer. In this community, my sense is that in some ways it's taken for granted that there's more to life than making money alone. That being said, basically everyone, at least that I know, uses money to address our lifestyle requirements. So how do we engage with that process by which money enters into our lives? Part of my work in the world is engaging with people who are asking that question in their lives. And I have seen that there's as many approaches to addressing it as there are people. I've seen people look to do good in the world now. I've seen folks try to think about making their money now and then giving it away when they are in a position to be able to do so. Others who look to integrate perspectives, and still others who ask questions of how to transcend the system itself. One of the people in our broader community took me for a walk on his farm, I want to say about 8 years ago. And he showed me a tree that was growing quickly because of the high quality soil that he had cultivated there. And he pointed to it and he said, "Do you see this tree? I can cut it down right now. And within 1 year, I'll have another tree just like it. And I can sell this tree right now and I'll get about $1,500. I can go on a European vacation." But then, as I reflect, I realize that the money is worth less to me than the tree. The tree is enough, and so I don't cut it down. And I'm curious about what happens inside of a person to start seeing the world in this way. What are the inner paths that led to our guests living lives that are veering away from the dominant paradigm and serving as beacons for others in their own journey? How does wealth relate to satisfaction and joy? Can livelihood be an expression of higher purpose? And can we design for not just the development of our heads, but also the hands and the heart? Our guests today are living into those types of questions now in their organizational leadership roles. Vidya Shah, she heads up Edelgive Foundation and is a well-known woman leader in finance outside of that. And Amit Bhatia has started multiple organizations in impact investing and social enterprise, including Aspire and GSGII. And he's led multiple organizations in the business world before that. Thank you both for joining us in conversation today. So with that as a little context, Vidya, I'd love to offer the floor to you first. Perhaps just sharing a little bit of initial thoughts on this context and topic as you feel appropriate.
Sure, Biju, thank you so very much. I've enjoyed every minute so far, including the lovely poem that Trupti offered to us. As I was thinking about, the topic of conversation today, actually, yesterday was Jagjit Singh, who's a very, very famous and an incredibly great human being, a ghazal singer, and much more than that. It's a very inapt description of him. And it was his death anniversary yesterday, so I was only listening to him yesterday. And one of his pieces is so beautiful. It's by a poet called Nida Fazli, and it's in Hindi Urdu, but I'm sure most of us can understand it. It says, "Dunya jise kehte hain, jadu ka khilona hai. Mil jaye to mitti hai, kho jaye to sona hai." So, you may get the world, but if you get it, it is worthless. And when you lose it is when you start realizing the value. So pretty much, I think a lot of the questions we're all surrounding ourselves with today, especially about how much is enough, it'll never be enough, seems to be the answer that all our saints keep telling us. And the idea is therefore to keep going within and answer the question for yourself. Rather than saying this, when this much is enough, I'll be happy, because that limit always keeps pushing away as time goes by. A lot of, you know, the way I've been thinking over the last 10 to 12 years has actually been shaped by my journey at Edelweiss and Edelgave. And the reason a financial services company like Edelweiss, you know, set up something like Edelgave was largely because as part of the founding team, we all came from very simple families. And we had the gift of parents who were forward-looking, of education, of being in India at the right time, at the right place. And these are all things that are, you know, gifts from the divine. And we felt, therefore, the earlier we give back, and we call it investing back, and not really giving back, because give has doesn't, even though we are called Edelgave. But the earlier we do that, the better it is, you know, for just keeping ourselves rooted. Because there's also this story about the Roman Empire, where, you know, when an emperor would come into the city having won a big conquest, there would always be a slave whispering in his ear, memento mori, which just tells, reminding the emperor that he is only a mortal, he's a mere mortal. And I think these are things that, you know, could define how we started thinking about not just the business, but also about how we wanted to run other parts of our life. And so we set up the foundation in a sense to, because we were very acutely aware that equal opportunity is one of the biggest gifts we can give to people around us. And that access to opportunity is what is of all kinds, whether it's an access to a livelihood or access to a good quality education, is what holds a lot of us back and keeps us in poverty. And that was really the thinking behind Edelgave. But along the way, I think there were, I've just been very fortunate to be with people who I think are just made differently. And I've just been incredibly so lucky about that. So a lot of my journey with Edelgave also began with, they must be in some way part of this, but Nimish Bhai, who's, Nimish Shah, who's, you know, and Ramesh Uncle, part of Caring Friends, who really looked at philanthropy in a very, very different way and actually got me off on that journey. And the way they thought and the way they, what they read, influenced me a lot. At the same time, I've just been lucky to be around great teachers like my yoga teacher, who also introduced me to the Yoga Sutras. So a lot of how I've been thinking has been conditioned by that. But recently, I think there are two things that have been weighing on my mind, particularly induced by so much distress, human distress that we've seen in this time of COVID. And, you know, I went back to using this time of working from home also to look at other things to learn and read. And I came across this course on Coursera run by a Yale professor, a young professor called Laurie Santos, who runs a course on positive psychology. And a lot of what she said actually exists in our texts, but there's this huge Western now lens on happiness. And everybody is grappling with that. So she runs this course for freshman students in at Yale, because there's very high rates of depression among college students, I think all over the world, but particularly in the United States. And a lot of the concepts she was sharing about gratitude, about writing a gratitude note to others every day, savoring experiences, and this whole thing about the world today is a place of social comparison. You're always comparing. There's a lot of miswanting. You're looking at wanting things rather than experiences. And even things like, you know, performing random acts of kindness, just being kind to people around you, or just making a social connection. I think these are things that she really explored in depth. And I also, through this course, came across Professor Martin Seligman, who really emphasized, you know, you can, different ways of being happy. You can have a pleasant life, which is, you know, you're always wanting something next to keep you happier. It could be a car or a home, but still it's just that next thing, a bigger car maybe. Or it could be engagement, where you know, really immerse yourself in something. It could be learning a new language or learning music, or it could be purpose. And I think everywhere the world around, we're coming back to purpose. And what is that purpose? What is that meaning you want to find in life, which has to be beyond the material, beyond aspiring to a certain number or a certain rank in different lists that, you know, keep floating around? And then you have, you know, people like Michael Norton, who's done so much research on how just giving gives you that happiness, you know, just giving money, spending money on others, he says. Money can buy happiness, he says, if you spend it on others. So I think this is the new things I started getting exposed to. And then I went back and I said, if you look at all our texts, you know, across the different philosophers who've been in the South Asian region, right, from Rumi to, you know, Khusro to Kabir to everybody, you know, it just keeps coming. Even our, you know, basic Hindu texts of Mahabharata or the Ramayana or the Gita, everything sort of comes back to saying, you know, what is your purpose going to be beyond, you know, your job or your livelihood? And in a way, can that livelihood itself provide that meaning to you? Rather than saying, I have purpose and then I have a job. And, you know, how do you co-mingle these things has been a very interesting thing to mull about. And then, you know, I went back to rereading a book called The Difficulty of Being Good, because you also seeing, along with all this distress, you're also seeing this incredible amount of hate in the world, you know, the incredible amount of divide that's pulling us, you know, and just creating this narrative of just bad feelings and bad emotions. And it's a, you know, he wrote this book because he wanted to focus on the four basic precepts in a sense in Hinduism, which is, you know, starting with Artha, Dharma, Kama and Moksha. And this book is about Dharma, you know, and he actually takes us beautifully through different characters. Like if you look like Duryodhana, in a way embodied envy, and a lot of his downfall, though he was such a great man in terms of his capability, his intellect, you know, it was just that one thing. And there is a line in the book where he talks about Dhritarashtra telling him that why should you be envying the Yudhishthira, because you have everything and all you need to do, even somebody like Dhritarashtra telling his son that all you need to do is to walk on the path of Dharma because you have everything. So I think he, you know, or about Arjuna, in a sense, this whole confusion in Arjuna's mind really, you know, defines Arjuna in a sense. Or even Karna, you know, who has his whole life is defined by status anxiety because he's so acutely aware that he's just a charioteer's son. So I think these are these different streams and strands that actually exist in our culture, in our mythology, and all we need to keep going back to them and explore them in these beautiful different ways through poetry, through literature. And a lot of it, the centering of course comes, you know, through that. So how do you keep doing this is something that, you know, as I told you before, I'm still exploring. I'm still in that sense of, you know, wanting to know more and exploring more in order to come to that question of, you know, how do you just be good and kind and stick to your dharma, to the meaning and the purpose that you've identified for yourself?
Thank you so much for that context, Vidya. I'm just struck by that quote about how inside of each of us we contain multitudes. As I hear you quoting scripture and context from Western positive psychology, and recognizing that you also lead an organization and you're bringing that into the work. Just to take a step back and recognizing we have an audience, I just want to share with folks, if you're feeling called to comment or ask any questions, you can do so in the chat window on the live stream page, or you can send an email at ask@servicespace.org. Again, that's ask@servicespace.org. And I would love to also hand it off to Amit to share some initial thoughts. And based on your experiences of building and leading impactful organizations, how do you parse these questions?
Thank you, Birju and Vidya, for your wonderful remarks. And good morning, friends. Like you all, I'm a seeker. And my quest to find an answer to how much is enough is best prefaced by a few short stories that have inspired my decisions. So let's start there. Almost 125 years ago, in 1893, a young Indian sage, Swami Vivekananda, stood in Chicago, speaking to an audience of 7,000. And there, he was there to introduce Hindu religion at the world's first parliament of religions. He spoke of our civilizational idea of inclusion, an idea that is still work in progress. But that summer, Swami Vivekananda met a wealthy American, John D. Rockefeller. Vivekananda, intrigued and vexed Rockefeller with his view that the money John had accumulated was not his, that he was merely a channel, a trustee, and his true duty was to use that money for the good of the society. John precipitously left the meeting. A week later, unannounced, he visited Swami Vivekananda again and placed on his desk a document which is the blueprint of his philanthropic plans to build a public institution. We all know what followed. The creation of Rockefeller Foundation, amongst the first and finest philanthropic institutions in the world. So just starting off, I can't help but reflect that it was 125 years ago when in modern capitalism, money first found meaning or profit met purpose. We're all here today because we believe our life's journey is incomplete if we don't find our own highest purpose or answer for ourselves. How much is enough? So let's fast forward 70 years on to 1963. The great German Nobel laureate Heinrich Bull takes us on a bright sunny day to a seafront where a smartly dressed tourist is taking photographs with an expensive camera. He notices a shabbily dressed local fisherman taking a nap in his fishing boat during work hours with no care in the world. He approaches the fisherman and asks him, why is he lazing in the sun instead of catching fish? The fisherman responds that he has already been out on sea and has enough catch for the next 2 days. The tourist tells him that if he goes out to catch fish multiple times a day, he would be able to buy a motorboat in less than a year, a second boat in less than 2 years, and so on. The tourist further explains that one day the fisherman could even build a small cold storage plant, a pickling factory, fly around in a helicopter instructing his fleet, and export lobster directly to Paris without a fish middleman. The nonchalant fisherman asks, then what? The tourist enthusiastically continues, then without a care in the world, you could sit in the harbor, doze in the sun and look out at the glorious sea. But I'm already doing that, says the fisherman, leaving the tourist pensive with envy. I use this story in my leadership dialogues and ask everyone in the room, who'd they rather be, the fisherman or the tourist? The tourist is clearly the modern corporate executive, workaholic, ambitious, who wants to maximize every day, every hour, put lofty goals, surpass them. But his critics will tell him, what use is that money if you can't enjoy it? Spend time with family, be with yourselves, be in the moment, hear your inner voice and not just the outer din. We know too many people, all of us, who are trying hard to get off that corporate treadmill, don't we? On the other hand, the fisherman on the idyllic beach may appear content, at peace, with not a worry in the world, making most of the summer and the nature. But he's vulnerable to weather, to health, to family needs, to economic necessities, and his critics won't allow him to pass off underachievement as nirvana. What would you rather be? The quintessential Aristotelian question, how much is enough? Is about a sustainable balance, not a balance sheet. Neither the tourist nor the fisherman can truly outline an inspiring balance. Which brings me, in search for balance, to my third and final contrast, to Gandhi and Friedman. The world just celebrated and derided 50 years of Friedman's famous New York Times article, "The Social Responsibility of Businesses to Make Profits." Friedman's philosophy won him a Nobel last century, but today it no longer holds good even in his own home. Last year, the CEOs of 181 US companies urged that business must look beyond its goal of profit making, serve not just the shareholder, but all stakeholders. The purpose of investment too is changing. We can now do good and do well together. That's the reason that between year 2000 and 2020, responsible, sustainable, and impact investments have grown from zero to $30 trillion. And PRI signatories account for $90 trillion. Impact can drive profits and need not impair it. Gandhi's philosophy was the antithesis of Friedman's Nobel Prize-winning thesis. much like Vivekanand, Gandhi believed that we are trustees of the wealth we come across, and we need to use it to improve the world. I feel Gandhi's vision really took off after he was gone. Vinoba Bhave, the independence activist and Mahatma Gandhi's spiritual successor, converted it to Bhutan, walking around the country 13 years. And later, with the assistance of Jayaprakash Narayan, extended it to Sampatidan. Amongst the big business leaders deeply influenced by this philosophy was J.R.D. Tata, who also vehemently disagreed with these gentlemen. In January 1955, as J.R.D. Tata found himself responding to a letter by Jayaprakash Narayan asking him to donate 1/6 of his annual income, he obliged unhesitatingly by donating 1/6 of his income after correcting his team's calculation upwards, insisting that his 1/6 should include income from all his sources, including all his trusts. But alongside, he wrote to JP, "I must confess," and I'm quoting, "I must confess that I do not share your understanding of the capitalist system or its place in industry. I sincerely believe that with adequate safeguards, the cooperative system and evolved capitalism are in their respective fields the most effective, if not the only forms of economic organizations combining decentralization of power, economic power, with efficiency." That was 75 years ago, and J.R.D. Tata was espousing the first principles of impact capitalism, that capital plus purpose equals impact. And therein, of all the treaties out there, lies a practical solution to our quest today of finding how much is enough. In fact, by juxtaposing Gandhi's trusteeship with the idea of an impact economy, we can make profit and purpose conjoined twins, balance our inner and outer pursuits, our head and our heart. So friends, to create a society where all can answer how much is enough, we must focus on the impact economy, where impact, an economic concept, like risk and return, measurable, comparable, and empirical measure of an action's benefit to people or the planet, is a must. I'm a child from a refugee family. My father arrived in India from what is now Pakistan on the eve of independence in August 1947 as a 7-year-old boy, walking miles for days. He landed in Amritsar. Refugee camps were in disarray. He worked as a porter at the Amritsar railway station for weeks before the family was relocated. Youngest of 7 kids, he studied little. He learned how to type, write shorthand, and became a lower division clerk. When he retired 40 years later, he was still typing. By age 10, I could myself type and change ribbons on a typewriter. My father may have been a simple clerk, but he had a vision. He knew how to disrupt low-income cycle. He invested in our education at great sacrifice. We lived very humbly, but we went to schools where children of our economic strata won't even dream to go. It had its impact. We did well. I have not forgotten from where I come or the debts I owe. In 2007, as I just turned 38, I decided to put half of all my savings in my charity Aspire Circle and my social enterprise Aspire Impact, and took on the second innings of my life as I answered how much is enough for myself. I've been in the impact sector last 13 plus years. In answering that question, I told myself, I'll give my kids a great education wherever in the world. It changes lives. It'll be their inheritance as it was mine. Have enough to lead a comfortable life, not a luxurious one, and hopefully have enough for medical exigencies. Of course, it took some courage, walking away from big, fat corporate salaries, stock options, and even your identity is not easy. But liberation comes at a cost. I tell my friends, I too missed business travel privileges, the gold and platinum card status, the support staff, and the corporate paraphernalia. But I can tell you, in recent years, I ran a global multilateral traveling over 6 months, you know, annually without a secretary or travel support. I find myself breaking fixed deposits every quarter as I pay fees for my children. And yet, 13 years into this, when I ask myself, is it worth it? The answer, unhesitatingly, every time, is yes. And I hope God keeps it that way. And I tell myself, to learn to fly, first we must learn to break free. How much is enough? We'll have 8 billion answers for 8 billion people. Bill Gates' Giving Pledge is a legendary evolution on what Rockefeller started 100 years before him. I will leave you with this. Business and capital can be a force for good. We should not make capital or profits the villain, though we must overthrow the tyranny of unfettered capitalism and profiteering. In the last 13 plus years, I feel gratitude for having founded or set up 4 successful nonprofit startups, Aspire Circle, you know, India's Impact Investors Council, the Global Steering Group for Impact Investment, and Social Finance India. I believe the idea of a sustainable growth is core to the idea of an impact republic, and it is steadily taking shape. We can all only find balance when we restore balance to our unequal world of crushing poverty and catastrophic climate change. The impact movement is a renaissance of social, environmental, and economic balance, all in harmony and proportion, ushering in a new form of conscientious capitalism, the impact economy. We can collectively create an impact economy where the world is in harmony, everyone has means to answer for themselves how much is enough, and this world need not be based on redistribution of income or wealth, on detachment or renunciation. The pursuit of impact economy is the pursuit of purpose, and the pursuit of purpose, to my mind, is indeed the highest aspiration of any life well lived. I pray you all embrace the impact revolution and answer how much is enough to find sustainable balance and inner peace. Thank you.
Beautiful opening comments, Amit. Thank you so much. I'm touched by hearing the both of you describe financial capital in such terms, where we start to move away from this polarizing that I heard Vidya speak to earlier. And it seemed a little bit to me like your own journeys started walking into this inquiry of how do we depolarize financial capital and start looking at things in different ways as we grow. And one of the words I heard each of you say that kind of dovetailed together as a listener was the word purpose, that purpose is what starts unlocking these kinds of insights. And so I wanted to just ask to start out my questions, to start at the level of livelihood as it connects to purpose. I'm curious how each of you would think about how we know that we're doing good work. You know, when we say that idea of purpose, it sounds so noble. But of course, you know, oil company executives feel that they're helping everyday people get home every day. And nuclear weapons manufacturers feel that they're integral to keeping the world safe. And on the flip side, we can wonder about the real social benefit that even comes from what the world may label philanthropy or impact. And so I'm curious, where do you draw the line to delineate what is purpose driven and what is not? Either one of you, or feel free to share first.
Vidya, do you want to?
No, Amit, you start.
No, thanks, Vidya. So, Birju, I think this answer is now getting fairly scientific of how do we try to look at our own vocations and livelihoods and what is evolving. And the reason I'm such a big fan of this impact movement is that the impact continuum is the right way to figure out where you lie in your livelihood and in your vocation to know how much good you're doing. The step one really has got to be what is the impact world calls responsible investing or responsible business, which is the A of the ABC of impact, saying avoid harm. So if an oil company does not understand that fossil fuels are putting carbon in the air, which is causing this climate change and hurricanes and wildfires and droughts and floods, you know, they are fooling themselves. So the A of the ABC of impact is we got to avoid harm. You want to step up in your life towards purpose, one more, you know, in another orbit, The B is benefit all stakeholders. Everything that we call green finance, blue finance, sustainable agriculture, renewable energy, sustainable fisheries, sustainable forestry is all this B, okay? And that's a step up from the A. And finally, the C of this impact continuum is, you know, contribute to solutions. You know, the impact investing world, affordable education, affordable health for the poor, microfinance for financial inclusion, water, sanitation, health. So I think if we are thinking of our jobs and our lives and livelihoods along the continuum, we will know how much impact we are having, and it will not be any longer a mystery. This is getting very scientific.
No, thanks so much, Amit. I mean, you know, I was hesitating to go first because, you know, how do you look at it from both lenses? And Amit has put the perspective of, you know, the capital side of it really beautifully, saying that capital should now start pursuing impact-oriented businesses, livelihood-generating opportunities that really have sort of the which bring the balance of purpose and business, you know, together. And it, but if you look at the other side, which is just ordinary people who just want to get on with their lives and earn a decent livelihood, I always wonder how much choice they have in, you know, depending on where they're living or their level of education, as to whether they can really choose a livelihood that is also environmentally friendly or it's purpose driven. So how do you tell an oil rig worker, by the way, you know, this is not really helping the, you know, helping the planet? So I think that is my, you know, inner confusion, saying that a lot of the people, for example, that we work with, they are in vocations not necessarily of their choice, and they are in those vocations because those vocations exist and in some ways are helping the economy, whether they're agrarian workers or they're just head loaders in Surat lifting bales of cotton on their back, or whether they're, you know, people who are cleaning the drains at abysmally low wages. There's purpose in all of that, but it's not necessarily a purpose of their choice. And that is what I keep grappling with. And ultimately, I think it's what Amit says, you know, it's the way, you know, capital is pursuing opportunities that are providing a return. The people who are behind that capital want a particular kind of return and therefore chases opportunities that provide them that. How do we get the people with the capital also to start thinking differently and investing more in businesses that matter both? And that is what Amit is doing, right? Is bringing that thinking to people with the capital. And that's why I keep getting, you know, pushed, because if I look at what's happened with migrant labor in the midst of COVID, where they've just thrown everything and gone back, and they will have to return to whatever they left behind because they have no choice. And that is my struggle. So ultimately, I think it's the people, you know, with the capital, people like us, you know, who have to drive very different choices of the opportunities that this capital pursues.
Thank you both. So what that brings up in me as a listener is just reflecting on how the inequities that are present from however the unfettered approach to capitalism has unfolded in the last few decades, how that puts us in a position where most people don't have this financial capital in substantive ways to be able to implement into the world. And so, you know, I come back to this service-based kind of view of small acts. And I'm curious to what extent that you've seen those kinds of small acts in your own context that would support that development of joy or wisdom and insight or compassion in the workplace, such that the oil rig worker who may not have or may not feel that he or she has the choice is actually able to start seeing that there's a lot more than what I choose to do, you know, with the larger purpose of my organization. It's not just that. That's, of course, a piece of it. But I have a choice every moment in terms of how I choose to show up to this workplace. And I'm curious if you guys have any examples from that telescopic lens of things that have touched you in the journey of evolution of people.
You know, I think when a lot of this whole concept of random acts of kindness really, really touches me. And I feel that it can become a very good habit. And it can start by being an exercise. And I've seen that then the brain just automatically smiles at somebody. You know, you automatically smile at somebody who's just even just trying to check your temperature as you're getting into your office premises. Or somebody who's opening the lift doors for you because that's his job. So I think it's very great if we can, as an exercise, say initially that so that it just becomes automatic and you don't have to even think, and it just starts changing how you look, how you behave, because you are smiling more, you are appreciating more, you are savoring all the gifts that you've had just automatically. And it's such a fantastic feeling to just wake up in the morning and just look at the sun and say, you rose and so I exist. I think these small things are great, and to share them has been my particular joy. And when we started Edelgay, one of the things we said is we didn't want to be sitting separately from the corporate, you know, saying, okay, this is a small bunch of people who's trying to do a set of things. And we wanted to create that bridge with and now 10,000 odd employees that we have at Edelweiss. So we actually created a bridge by saying, come and help us build the capacity of these nonprofits. And we've had an incredible experience of, we have a very high participation rate in our programs. About 85% of our employees give in some way or the other, either time, their money, they teach, they volunteer. And it's been very, very transformative for them. And there are small examples. There's this young woman who was a mentor to a group of 10 girls from one of the communities in Mumbai. And all she was doing is once a week on every Saturday, she'd have a 2-hour call with this girl who was highly aspirational and wanted to be, you know, she had a lot of questions. She wanted to move from her slum. She wanted to work. Her aspiration was to be able to be a bank officer. And just these calls, and the day she cleared her exam, this girl called her and both of them just started weeping. And she said, it just transformed how I started looking at things. So I find that especially, I don't know how it is with the rest of the world, but we are so cocooned. You know, we grow up in certain communities, we go to certain schools, we work with certain organizations. And most of us are just oblivious of how life happens around us. And this opportunity to observe and to participate in very, very small ways is incredibly transformative. So this is a joy I think we should be able to share with everybody. It gives so much more back. And we keep talking now about receiving and not giving, you know, that you receive so much when you do this, you know, and you do it completely selflessly and it starts becoming automatic behavior. And can you imagine so many more people smiling, so many more people just being nice to each other?
Thank you. I'd love to hear Amit's reflection.
You know, Vidya mentioned something very interesting as she started off saying this can become a habit. And I think in my life has less of randomness and more of habits, as you know. So whenever I find something working well, I'm the kind of guy who's been trained, despite as much as I may try to unlearn, who writes a business plan on it, executes it, and builds an organization. I'll give you a couple of examples. When I started off Aspire, you know, Circle, amongst the many things I was doing was just going traveling around the world, especially in rural areas in India. I started off doing, you know, Aspire in Kashmir, saying that's where, you know, I got to start. And in the first 6 months, I found myself one day sitting, you know, at the Hyderabad airport, and there was a sports person sitting next to me. The girl looked, you know, as if I've seen a photograph in the press, and I, and she had, I could see a, you know, some badminton rackets in the bag, and I said, "You're a badminton player." She said, "Yeah." I said, "What, you know, I've seen you, you play for the country." She said, "Yeah, I'm the national champion. My name is Saina Nehwal." I said, "Wow, okay." I said, "You know, where are you going?" She said, "For a tournament." And, you know, we started talking about sports and cricket, and she started saying how nobody supports sports like badminton. This is back in 2000. She was about number 50 in the world at that point in time. And I said, I tried to understand how much a little support as a person of very small means, what could take people. And, you know, she just described her father who worked in the Agricultural Research Institute, you know, has very basic income. And it appeared to me in that conversation that as little as 1.5 lakh rupees a year could have meant a lot to a Saina Nehwal at that point in time. And, you know, I can tell the story. She's spoken about it herself. I canceled my flight and went to see her dad. You know, she immediately connected me to her father. I went to see her dad in Hyderabad. You know, I said, okay, we'll do this support every year. Over the next 5-6 years, she went on to be eventually number one. But the moment we had found that there's a way to support, even with small, I thought, you know, sports people, you've got to have crores and you can't help them, you can't, and we now have 30 such people, you know, Saina Nehwals, the hockey captain of India, who's the daughter of a, you know, a bullock cart driver in, you know, Ambala, Rani Rampal, the first amputee athlete to climb Mount Everest, you know, and so on. So, but, you know, every time I found there, and there are many other examples I can give that, you know, and a random conversation, a random act of figuring out how to support someone else, not necessarily the kindness that your viewers may all have in mind, or a charitable kindness, but, you know, support someone else in their journey. And I, you know, I ended up going and building something after it. So we built these Aspire Circle scholarships that have gone on for 10, 11 years. And I think to your, you know, to answer this is, if we try and reach out, you know, to the other and have conversations we're not used to, there will be signals out there of what we can all do in being more helpful, purposeful, etc. But in the process, give ourselves also, you know, the license to feel that, you know, our life is well lived. So I think I've had many of these journeys, but I'll hold some to answer your further questions, Birger.
Well, I really appreciate that context. That, you know, whether it's random or whether it's habit, it seems to me that what we're talking about here is small acts of relationship. And that's very powerful to me. I mean, we're really talking about the possibilities that come out of relationship. And so I'm curious to understand a little bit, just sharing a little bit further on the question of the conversation from the top line, how much is enough? I would be remiss for not shifting it into the kind of practical side of that and to say, like, is there a number that's actually enough? Like, each of you are talking about these lovely things and shifting in this different way of thinking, but I've also heard each of you describe this moment of shift in your life where you stepped into that. And prior to that, there was, I would imagine, some different kind of feeling inside. And so I'm curious, how should the audience think about this question of accumulation and addressing that inner part of themselves?
You know, I think it'll be very unfair of me to just say that it's easy. I think my journey has been relatively easier because you know, I have a spouse who earns, and you know, when we started out Edelweiss, for example, I had a job that enabled us to, you know, live reasonably comfortably. I'd had a child by then. And Rasesh, my husband, could start Edelweiss with being paid almost nothing, you know. But that changed. And at some point, I could reverse it. And then, you know, when I started Edelgave, of course, you know, I said I wouldn't take any remuneration for what I did. And that was only possible only because I had a spouse who was earning. And so therefore, I think there has to be a balance between being practical and not just being, you know, saying that purpose can be built on a foundation of no money. I think that's just being real, you know. As far as the problem comes when when there's a number. And the first number usually, and I can say from my experience, is always a mathematical expression of what you define as a comfortable life, right? So maybe enough for children's education or marriage or a house, a decent car, maybe a holiday a year, and you can budget all of that and you can, and then extrapolate it into your old age and say, oh, maybe I'll live, I don't know how long I'm going to live, and it's going to cover all my medical expenses. It starts out like that. And then life takes over and you see your peers and, you know, you willy-nilly you start comparing, you know, we, especially for MBAs like me, you come out of business school and you see, oh, that person is already CEO, and that kind of rat race starts taking over, and that number, that goalpost, you forget why you set this goalpost, and then that goalpost keeps getting extended, and it, you know, and that is the start of, you know, all the problems that we have in life. And you know, we are also the 80s generation from a work perspective, so you have this greed is good kind of you know, thing that you've seen and you've experienced and all of that, till you realize what the hell is going on with you. And luckily, I think some of us have reached that place where you define comfort a particular way. And I think Amit also said that it's not luxury, it's comfort. You're comfortable. And it ideally should be, I still think it should be a mathematical expression where you just draw a line in the sand and say, everything else I will give away. I may make more, but I will start giving it away. I think that's the way for me is defining what is enough.
And I'll just add to that, Birju, saying, to my mind, this is not a number. How much is enough is not a number. And it reminded me, let me quote a little study which Reserve Bank of India did. It was about a decade or 15 years odd back. They did a study on, you know, a rare study on giving. It was actually limited to the state of Kerala amongst the poor. And that study found the very poor in India were giving away 3% of their annual income into charitable, and it was predominantly religious giving. And as you know, there's fair amount from time a child is born, marriage, there's death, everything is real. And at the point in time, the rich were giving away 1.5% of their annual income. So if you were to just compare that, hey, wealthy in India are giving 1.5%, that number I believe is 2.5 or around there now. You know, Vidya does these studies regularly, she'll know better. But you know, the poor were giving away. So this is not about wealth, it's about values. How much is enough has nothing to do. And while, you know, people like me define that line wherever we did, it's not because we are role models of any sorts. I think unless if you're a Warren Buffett or, you know, Bill Gates or a Rockefeller and doing it at that level where billions can, you know, take a disease out of a continent, absolutely those. Or if you are these poor, I think they are a role model that they can say, hey, you know, we barely have something to eat, and but they'll still give away 3-5% or more. You know, I think they are. You know, I'll end this by saying, look, my mother, you know, did MA in Sanskrit. She was all her life a Sanskrit teacher. I grew up on mythology, and I heard enough stories growing up of poor, you know, when they have just a slice of bread left, how they would be willing to share it. So how much is enough is defined in so many different ways by so many people that it is, you know, one thing I'm sure of is it is not a number.
Thank you both. I think lots to chew on. We've been getting some questions, several questions on exactly this question of how to think about what is enough. I do want to invite our listeners back to asking questions or sharing comments either through the live stream chat window or ask@servicespace.org. I'd love to ask one more question and I'll turn over to the audience questions. And I'm curious, with both of you living these lives that, from my understanding, are really elevated in society in terms of thinking about that intersection of being able to find sustenance, but at the same time engage with these moral questions of how to be in alignment and look at oneself in the mirror. I'm curious what your reflections are on the limits of this. What are the limits of philanthropy and social enterprise Do you see any blind spots and ways to continue in the growth and unfolding?
With the, if you don't, I can go at that first because I'm strongly opinionated about that. And Birju, I believe you cannot build a sustainable planet if your capital is not sustainable. So philanthropy not just has limits, it has very strong limits and a very small perimeter. It must be focused absolutely on areas where we, you know, disaster relief, you know, dire circumstances where people genuinely need help. But I think this world has found in the last several decades ways to convert every social and environmental challenge into a business opportunity. And I think more and more as we redirect capital and asking the question, you know, how do we make sure that we are not only talking about return, but in the same sentence talk about we earn 12% IRR while sending so many girls to school in India, or making sure so many people in garment factories in Bangladesh had health benefits, or making sure so many farmers in Kenya, you know, were able to get the organic fertilizer. I think that is what the world is asking for. And pensions and mutuals, they are doing this. A small $1 billion pension fund in Christian, so-called Christian Super in Australia, sends an annual return statement to all its pension holders. Exactly as I said, your money earned 7% while doing all this. And you can, how it makes people feel good. So I think there are limits to philanthropy. And therefore, the scarce philanthropy, the 500 odd billion that happens annually, should be directed at the most vulnerable, the poorest of the poor. But for many other parts of us, we have found ways of building this impact economy, because there's 200 trillion of global wealth to be redirected. There's too much emphasis of this 500 billion. You know, I think it just distracts the people of thinking what to do with that big elephant out there. And I think the more we can redirect the big elephant, this 500 billion philanthropic pool will be used much better for the most vulnerable.
I think, you know, one of the things that, because I've been in this field, and, you know, if you see there have been a few books in the last few years. I mean, the most famous and the most debated one has been Anand Giridhar Das's book, which has really questioned very deeply whether philanthropy is actually doing good. And especially as philanthropy is becoming bigger and bigger, the ability to impact in a way that's sometimes being seen as having narrow interests or perhaps conflicted interests. I think there's a lot more debate that's emerging on that, especially because philanthropy is becoming really large right now. So therefore, I always go back to what Rohini Neel Kenny has been speaking about, both she and Nandan, which is really looking at this intersection of what they call Samaj, Bazaar and Sarkar, which is roughly community, government and business. And seeing how that the roles of all of the three actually have to be in balance. And one or two of them actually become overwhelmingly powerful in different ways, then the other, you know, tends to be highly, you know, muted. Or so if you see in countries like the United States, actually, for a long time, there was balance between the three. There's an innate culture of giving. There is philanthropy is very important. Government was important, but business was also important. So there was a balance. And you have seen around the world that balance has begun to shift. In countries like India, you have a government which is very powerful. You have business, which is powerful, but over time, the role of communities in decision-making, in deciding their own future and their own fate has gotten crushed in a sense. And I think that is the role of philanthropy can be to re-energize communities to imagine how they want their lives to be lived. And I think a lot of the work that we are seeing in India has been around communities. The whole movement around, say, for example, collectivization of women, you know, to it. So all SHG movement in India by women has been an incredibly path-breaking moment where women have been able to find voice, they've been able to find choice, they've been able to assert these things, I think, is starting to become important. And how, if philanthropy can shift that balance to make it a more balanced world, where it's not just business deciding that, you know, this is a market opportunity and we move in, but also there's a balance in terms of participation of communities, in terms of sensible regulation and policy from government. I think that will help, you know, philanthropy also not become larger than life. And I have seen a lot of mistakes that even philanthropists have made where they feel they know the solution to the problem. And when it's not referred back to communities, a lot of money, it gets wasted, but sometimes there's also a lot of unintended consequences. And that is something that we have to be aware of.
Thank you both. I think this is kind of the tip of the iceberg in thinking about the nuance of this question. There's so many pieces to delve into, perhaps a separate conversation in itself. I do want to go to a few of the questions that have already come in. The first one I'd love to share, it says, in the question of how much is enough, what do you think is the role of outer wealth and inner wealth? And I'm thinking of, you know, the earlier shares that you both had about it's not just that it's hard to walk away from the dominant paradigm because of the money, but it's also because of the identity and that sense of a lot of inner capital is connected, social or otherwise. And so this person's asking about the joy and the satisfaction. What helped you tap better into inner wealth in your life, such that you are able to step forward and through the prior way of being? And how can we optimize for inner resources such that we can also take such steps?
So, Biju, I can take a, you know, shot at it. And when I think of this outer, you know, wealth, inner wealth, I think the first thing that comes to me is this myth that we may have propounded for centuries, that somehow in relinquishing the real world, the world of action, and trying to get this all, you know, omnipotent knowledge out there, you know, is the only way, you know, to a nirvana. And I believe that having a vision without action is actually delusion. You know, you cannot relinquish your responsibility, you know, to actually act on things that, you know, that are so unequal, that are, you know, problems that we see all around. And therefore, this is about a balance. Therefore, this is a balance between our inside and outside, and not either or. And it's not about, you know, and I know those images are so powerful, the serene Buddha sitting under the tree, or even Gandhi at his Sabarmati ashram. You know, we have romanticized this solitude, you know, as the only way. And there is power in that, you know. And one of my things on my list is a Vipassana later in December. And so I'm not denying that but I think if we were to think that it's only about something inside and not about action outside, I believe we are not using, you know, the Almighty's creation and the power He's given us, you know, to serve and to truly be servant leaders, which should be one of the most important purposes of our life.
No, I think Amit's just put it so beautifully, because that balance between the inner self and what's happening around you, and ultimately, I think a lot of what happens inside you is also influenced by what is happening around you. And the more you get taken in by everything that you see, the more unbalanced one becomes, right? So if you see the second sutra of the Yoga Sutras, which says that yoga chitta vritti nirodha, which is in a broad sense, yoga is that state where you can comfortably control the oscillations of the mind. But the oscillations of the mind are entirely driven by how you see the world. And therefore, you know, changing in an inner way through meditation practice or through any other way, is as important as doing that while being in life. You know, like Amit said, it's impossible to go, you know, for years and sit under a tree and meditate and find that inner self. You have to live your life and you have to still do it. And achieving that balance, so that level of being in it and being thoughtful and you know, that is the current conflict that we all have, because there are times when, you know, you get triggered by something and then you catch yourself. But even the act of catching yourself itself is important while you're, you know, in and about doing what you need to do every single day.
Thank you both. I want to go to starting to combine questions because we're getting a lot coming in. I've got one, two actually, one from Sandur and one from Neera. And the question is about getting into this space and starting to walk in this path personally. When a person decides to get into volunteering or philanthropy, there's so many ways to start heading down that path. What are ways that may be skillful to kickstart doing it, both as an adult, but also what are ways to expose younger people to this, whether it's from a curriculum or stories or who knows what, and be curious your reflections.
So I can talk about how I sort of did it personally with my children. When they were very young, I would take them with me on field visits. I remember the first, you know, place we went to was with Nimish Bhai and uncle to Sholapur, where we actually visited a residential school for the children of commercial sex workers. And they were little. I think my daughter was maybe 5, my son was 9 or 10. They thought they were just going on a train journey. I hadn't told them much about what we were doing. They were very curious. They met the children. They played with them. And all they did throughout that was actually listening. And I think it has a lot of these things about just taking children with you, because rather than talking to them about things, when they do things, and they do things in as natural a way as possible, rather than you prepping them, oh, you're going to a school with underprivileged children and you're going to be, you know, drawing with them or sharing your crayons. It's I think it's very put on. You have to immerse yourself and you have to make this as natural a setting for them that they don't see anything unusual. You know, they see it, they just realize gradually as they grow older that they have so much to be grateful for. I think over time it's helped them figure out how they want to volunteer and where they want to volunteer, and they continue to do that in different ways. And I've seen that at Edelweiss as well. Initially, people are very reluctant. They get very confused. You know, how will I do? Will I be able to bear it? And there are people who are worried about their own emotional reaction. There are people who are worried about, you know, different things. But it's just the first experience, and I find that people then figure that this is fairly transformative and there are some people who say, you know, this is not for me. I'd rather give to charity and be happy that way. So I think it's only by doing, and by doing it in as natural and in as thoughtful a way, that you are able to find what works for you best.
And that is it requires no further, you know, views. But if the audience, they are young, I'd just re-endorse what Vidya said. And I think some of these internships and volunteering are the best ways to get started when you're very young, if you don't have people to tour with. But if you are a little more, you know, tenured, like I was when I made a decision, you know, your head, you will find your head telling yourself it's a reckless decision to leave it all and jump into this world, and it will be hard, and you cannot have enough safety net. So the best thing is to jump, to just be reckless, because experiencing zero gravity is an act of recklessness, and that's with the state of mind you'd have 15, 20 years into your career. And there too, you know, the only way you can, you know, kind of ensure that this is a more graded fall is go work for a social enterprise, go work with at someone who's at the cross section of doing good and doing well, or an impact enterprise, and learn about the sectors that you're passionate about to fully, you know, immerse yourself later on. So you can grade those learnings, but I think with the hit the nail on the head.
Thank you both. I feel like going a little deeper into this, it naturally flows with the questions coming in. I'm going to try to combine two again. One is more of a comment, and then the other is more of a question. But I think they're both going into this nuance of balance that I hear you both speaking to. Bradley asks or comments that a student of mine recently told me, if you have something that is more valuable to someone else than it is to you, then you should give it to them. And I'm so grateful for this lesson, yet I'm still caught in this idea that I need to save enough for retirement. Even though as I was filling out my daughter's financial aid form for college, I was thinking to myself, I can't believe how much we have, and yet we're asking for more. Making this shift within our society after living it for 55 years is so very challenging, and having family members with differing philosophies complicates things more. That's his comment, and there's a question that felt similar to me, where the questioner said, you know, a lot of the bar for stepping away from the dominant paradigm way of life is not just external. It's not just internal in terms of identity. It's also in terms of competition and comparison, looking around and saying everyone else is saving for retirement. Maybe I didn't save enough. How are you able to tap into the nuance of your own, you know, right sense of balance before making such a move? How do you know that you've done it enough?
Well, it's a tough question, Birju, in the sense that, you know, because if you were to ever say you know it, you're already assuming, you know, that you have knowledge to judge when, and it goes, you know, in the face of that we're all seekers. So we will never know what is that most, that is the most perfect balance. There is none. But there are, you know, degrees of these balances. I know I'm not there yet, because I think when I think of how will this balance evolve, I think of a journey to minimalism where I'm far, far away from that. So I know that I'm not there, but I know it's very hard for anyone to be able to say, or boy, it's, you know, beyond immodest that to be able to say I have achieved a great balance. But I know I, you know, that when you're on a path, I know my path, I can see, you know, years and years ahead that it is a path where you can achieve that with minimalism.
No, I completely echo Amit. I mean, I constantly think about this question myself. And like he said, you know, you're, in fact, the pandemic has taught us how little we actually need. You know, I'm sure all our wardrobes are full of too many clothes and too many things. So I think the one thing I'd like to say is that when you're giving, we always want it to be significant. And what is significant to us may actually be a lot more significant to somebody else. So therefore, you know, even if you start really small, it can be incredibly significant to somebody else. You know, it doesn't have to be that big bequest or that big. And another thing that has happened, partly because we have so many rich billionaires and other very, very rich people who've, you know, sort of made pledges and things, we sometimes get caught by saying, you know, is this going to be meaningful? But it is definitely, whatever the amount is, is definitely meaningful. And therefore, it doesn't have to be that it's going to be my retirement or this. It can be both. If you do, and it can be acts of kindness as much as it can be actual dollars sort of going out. And you'd be amazed at how small amounts, I have seen how small amounts actually make such a big difference.
Thank you both. I'm curious what at this stage in each of your development journey, you are each feeling most alive in learning and stepping into. What is that edge of your own becoming?
I think, you know, the last few years actually have made me, fill me with a lot of disquiet and uneasiness. And I've always tried to explore what is it, because it's not about the money, it's not about the work, it's just generally about the state of the world. And when you think about things like that, you know, people around you say, you can't do anything, so you why are you even thinking so much about it? And through your work, you're hopefully, you know, at least some people are seeing the benefit of it, so you should be happy. And then as I sort of delve deeper into it, I realized that actually we can. A lot of people feel the similar disquiet about the polarization largely we are seeing and the hate we are seeing. And so a friend of mine said, why don't you voice it? Why don't you start writing about it? And so about 7 weeks ago, tomorrow is my 9th or 8th blog actually on LinkedIn, where I started writing about what I call the democracy of stories. And I just started writing, and it's just taken a path. It's almost like a river which is just finding its own way. I don't know what the next few blogs are going to be about. But a lot of it is about how what we hear, what we're being told, and how we need to actually reflect and find our own meaning and our own understanding, our own interpretation of things, rather than just seeing things in a very, very unidimensional way, because a lot of what we are hearing is forcing us to be unidimensional. And when I started writing it, I thought, you know, it's given me immense satisfaction. Every Saturday and Sunday, all I do is research and write the blog. And then I started speaking to a few people, and a few friends of mine said that they actually like reading it because it's giving voice to what they feel as well. And they don't feel that they're in the same position of being able to voice it. And it gave me some satisfaction that maybe there are other people out there also who think similarly. So I'm pushing this journey of trying to pen what I feel. That gives me a lot of satisfaction. And in doing that, I'm exploring a lot of boundaries of what I read, what I expose myself to in terms of reading. The fact that, you know, everything I've grown up, even though it's not been a very typical Hindu upbringing, but a lot of what I've been exposed to is Hindu thought, Hindu mythology, Hindu texts. How do you broaden that? How do you learn about other religions? How do you bring that balance in, even in what you're seeing, hearing, feeling? So that's been my edge of exploration and inquiry.
Beautiful.
And Birju, I am, you know, I'm a believer and in the pursuit of a systemic change. I have for far too long felt frustrated when individual or even small community efforts appear like drawing a knot. You know, we've all found ourselves picking up the little garbage, throwing it in the bin in a park on a roadside, and there comes a fast car and a bike and a few will throw things right at your face, and there you know that howsoever, you know, you might invest in education, that you need systemic change. You know, on the air quality and pollution, we've tried doing so much, and you know, a government simple odd even formula in a state like Delhi can suddenly change half the carbon off the road. you know, and you can, and you, so systemic change is critical. And we are at the cusp in 21st century to be able to add the idea of impact to the risk and return equation. And just like in the middle of last century, we first learned how to measure risk when capital asset pricing model came and Markowitz and Sharpe ratio and the efficient frontier were discovered. There's a Nobel Prize waiting for someone who discovers how to ensure impact is measured, comparable, and you know, across companies. And earlier this year, I don't know if people noticed, but Danone published for the first time as a carbon adjusted EPS, showing the world that they earn 30% less, you know, if they accounted for their carbon footprint. And that Emmanuel Faber is so courageous, you know, to be able to do something like that and show the world what a real P&L impact weighted P&L balance sheet should look like is amazing. I think we are, you know, we are again at a time in economic history where a 250-year-old system of capitalism 1.0, where we have believed and worshipped in the invisible hand, needs an invisible heart to guide it. And that, to my mind, is impact. And just like in the last century, Keynes, you know, and Friedman fought on two different philosophies, if we can ensure that the idea of this impact economy wins, we need not be that single lonely soul picking up that little piece of paper on a road and have someone again throw a whole peels of banana on your face. We can, you know, get a systemic change to happen. And that is the edge of my discovery, can one, and that's what Aspire Impact does. And, you know, bulk of my effort is on focus on that big elephant. There are small tweaks, you know, when which done at a systemic level can do big change, you know. And if we focus on that, we may probably just push it beyond that tipping point, and we are close to it.
Wow. I exit this conversation both inspired and touched. I was reflecting on what it is that I would take away. I'd love to share that before I hand it back to Amit or to Rohit, who I think will close for us. We're almost at our time so quickly. The first thing that came up for me was purpose and how important purpose is to almost dissolving the question of what is enough. And the dissolution of that question is really strongly connected to stepping away from polarization and binaries. That, you know, how do we start moving away from this is good livelihood and this is bad livelihood, but steps into a deeper form of inside ourselves. And it may not be so clear, you know, that came across a lot in the questions and answers that seem to be coming up, that living with not knowing is okay, but we still feel called to experiment. You know, we only have this one life, maybe not, one that we know of. I'd love to hand it over to Rohit and my gratitude again for the opportunity to hear your wisdom.
Thank you, Vidya, Amit, and Birju for that really inspiring and illuminating conversation. And I think just in gratitude to that purpose, which inspires all of us in mysterious ways to, as Amit said, give up our own comforts at many times to create possibility for a deeper emergence, for a deeper growth within and without. I would like to invite you all for a minute of silence and gratitude, and we'll close the call after that. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.